to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show. It's Friday, end of the week. Thank goodness it is Friday and heading into the weekend. I actually have to work over the weekend. I'm trying to get this project from heck out of the day job. A huge amount of work, too little money, but I got to get it done and get it out of here so I can get on to some more remunerative circumstances. But that's not your problem. That's my problem. It's Friday, end of the day. It's late in the day where you are. It's just lunchtime here and a little bit of rain. And other than that, though, but yeah, it feels nice to be kind of going into a weekend. And even if you're working on a weekend, at least you can kick back and say, ah, it's the weekend, and you can kind of do all that stuff. All right. Donovan is in the control rooms, as usual, twiddling the dials, keeping us out of trouble. And our phone number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. So when you call in, when I annoy you, anger you, encourage you, or whatever, and you want to talk on the air, Donovan will be answering the phones and plugging you into the mixer board so that we may share the wisdom globally. All right, now, getting into the news here today. The Dow was kind of interesting to watch because it was kind of on both sides of the line. In fact, it was rather a volatile day. It was going up and down in green, red, green, red, green, red. And then toward the end of the day, when it looked like it was going to end just slightly in the red, all of a sudden is this huge upward shove that just spikes it up to plus, 100 points. And so that they can end the week in the green. And you heard on the news break, they're saying a last-second rally. They don't even have an explanation for it. It's just all of a sudden a lot of buy orders came in from somewhere. They don't even know where the market went up. Folks, I think it's pretty much a given at this point that the government is, manipulating the stock market to use as a political device so that they can lead off and say, yes, the stock market is up. And then they go in and they talk about the other really, really bad news. For example, the Chicago Purchasers May Index shrank at a faster pace than it had been in April and March and February and so forth and so on. Basically, what that means is business activity in the United States is continuing to contract. Businesses are downsizing. Businesses are closing. Businesses are having to let people off and go into hibernation. That's what the Chicago Index really shows. Business activity on the whole is shrinking in the United States. Now, we've been talking earlier in the week about how credit card companies are cutting their cards off. Advant has canceled all of their business, small business cards. Other credit card companies are sending out letters to people saying, we'll let you pay off your balance at a lower interest rate if you will voluntarily cut your card off right now, and all sorts of other deals like that. What this all means, the inavailability of consumer-level credit, the retraction of consumer-level credit, because we're not even seeing the mortgages come back. After all the hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars, poured into the banks and lending institutions, and we were all told that this was a valid spending of public taxpayer funds because it would bring the credit back to us, and it didn't happen. And what this means is, and you got to pay attention to this part, the financial insiders know for a fact the high-paying jobs are not coming back to Americans. It is not going to happen. They are getting out right now. They're taking their money. They're just going to sit in it and spend on it, go on vacation, take early retirement, whatever. The $12.8 trillion of your tax money that you are on the hook for did not buy you a return to the economic good times that you knew before. It did not buy you back to your previous standard of living. The withdrawal of consumer-level credit from the credit cards, from the mortgages, from all of that is a signal that the financial industry as a whole knows that you're never going to get back those high-paying jobs you used to have. And they're dealing with that reality, and they're just saying, well, you got to deal with that reality. You're only going to be making 56% of what you were making last year. Remember, we talked yesterday, federal tax revenues have declined 44% since this time last year, which means Americans as a whole are only earning 56% of the money they were earning just a year ago. That's how bad the situation is. And so they're sending a message, well, you're just going to have to get used to living on that little money, and we're not going to loan you anymore because we know that you're already going to have to spend most of that money you're still making paying off that $100,000 per taxpayer bill that got dumped on you and all of this TARP this and bailout that and PPI and LSQ and PDF and BFD programs that they're dropping all over the place. And they're doing it in all these little chunks to sort of keep you from really appreciating the sheer scale of the robbery that is going on. $12.8 trillion. That is a huge, vast sum of money. It's so big, most people can't even get their heads around it. You know, they just start looking at all those zeros and they go, I can't deal with that anymore. And so it's just a number. And you don't realize, when you bring it down to the level of the individual taxpayer, $100,000 per taxpayer, per working American taxpayer, that's just in the last 8 months. And before that, you still had your share of the national debt accumulated over the last 100 years, almost, since the Federal Reserve went into operation. And that was another $45,000 to $50,000 per taxpayer. And so it's the numbers are just piling up. And they're just expecting that you will work yourself to death for the rest of your life and just throw the money at the government and the financial industry so that they can play with it back and forth. And they can't, they're basically admitting they cannot revive the economy. They can't fix it. They can't bring back the jobs you used to have. Congress connived with the corporations to take those jobs away from you and send them to other countries. And they're not even trying to bring them back. They don't want to bring them back. The corporations think it's fine. You know, our stockholders are happy. We don't need to make products anymore. We have financial products. We don't make products to make money. We've made money the product, and we take it, and we bundle it, and we tie it in ribbons, and we put plans around it, and more paper instruments, and we bundle it and connect it and derive it. And that's our industry. That's the American industry, is playing with the money. We're a nation of money changers now, or at least the rich people are. The rest of us, you know, we're down here on our oars, rowing away, and hoping that the captain won't want to go water skiing after lunch. But that is really, in a nutshell, where our country went wrong. We forgot about making products to make money, and our government and our corporate culture just decided they'd just make money the product. And financial instruments, financial products. And it's all just shuffling the paper around. And gambling. It's legalized gambling. Gambling is, you know, a financial instrument, a money product. Because when you go into a gambling casino, they're not selling you a product. You know, they're going to loan you the dice and the chips. But you're just playing with the money. Money is the product. And it is really a very seriously skewed view of the world, where money is the end-all and be-all of everything, and all other values are simply discarded and rescinded. You know, no wonder our country wound up torturing children. We have no soul left. We have no heart left. We don't care about making good quality products anymore. It's just piling up those numbers, and whoever gets the biggest numbers somehow thinks that St. Peter is going to let them in ahead of everybody else. Or some such thing. Wealth is the sign of the elect. I've heard that from several different religious denominations. It's not confined to any one religion. A lot, especially some of these evangelical ministries who are multi-millionaires. You know, their justification is, you know, God intended for us to have the money and the wealth. So we are doing his will by grabbing the money all to ourselves. All kinds of really weird justifications there. And it's just, it's amazing. Now, the latest flim-flam here, this is a real quick one before we end this break here. There is a one of the many programs they have with TARP and the bailouts is called the Public-Private Investment Program, or the PPP. And it provides government subsidies, more of your tax money, to private investors to encourage them to buy some of these not quite wonderfully performing legacy loans from the banks, the so-called toxic assets. Okay, and the idea was for the toxic assets to kind of get spread out around the society and sort of minimize the damage at any one point. And it all sounded really good. But now the banks are coming in and saying, well, if you give us that taxpayer subsidies, we'll buy those legacy loans from ourselves. Just think about it here. I mean, they're going to take taxpayer money to buy these toxic assets from themselves. So they still have the toxic assets, and they've got your money to go with it. Talk about a double shuffle flim-flam here. We're going to take a break here. We'll be back after these words from our...
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
the Genesis Communications Network. And now, set your eyes on the future, and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. We're just wrapping up on the economy and a couple of other ideas here. We were talking about this public-private investment program, which was originally set up at taxpayer expense to encourage private investors to buy some of these toxic assets from the banks. The idea being that between what they thought the assets should be worth and what the banks were trying to sell them for, or taxpayer dollars would sort of fill that gap in order to make it an attractive buy. Well, what the banks are now saying is, well, we'll just do that. We'll sell the toxic assets back to ourselves, and taxpayer money will come in and make up the difference there. And won't that really be wonderful? And so basically, the banks still have the toxic assets, and they've got more of your tax money. And it is a situation just ripe for exploitation. And it's a ripoff. It's really, you know, it's a complete ripoff because the bank gets to set the price on what these assets are going to be worth. So it's a real scam. And behind all of this, of course, is a comment I've been making all along. We have a government which, with rare precious exception, is made up of lawyers and bookkeepers. And so every solution they come up with is in terms of making a law or changing the way the books are being kept. It's kind of like the law of the hammer, which says that if you give a small boy a hammer, everything he encounters will need to be pounded on. And that what it is saying is that people use the tools they're familiar with, and they don't see the value of skills they don't have. And so as our economy is deteriorating, the government is thinking solely in terms of passing more laws, passing more taxes, and the accountants and CEOs and business managers are thinking about, well, if we value these assets this way and we push this paper over here, we can at least make it look like it's okay. But the reality goes back to the fact that the economy rests on the foundation of its working class, middle class entrepreneurs who build the products that are sold to other countries that bring money into the system, real money of value, not just more of the paper. But real value, real worth, has to come into the system. And as I said in the first segment, the fact that consumer-level credit is being pulled back as hard as they can right now is a sign that the financial industry knows those high-paying jobs are not coming back, which is not a surprise. Our government isn't doing anything to bring them back. And that is really the problem right there. Now, I know a lot of people are saying that this is intentional on the part of the government, and it may well be. We've been hearing all this talk. I know Alex Jones thinks that they're trying to bring this huge, huge, huge crisis to bring about the New World Order, and that may be too. I'm sure everybody's got an agenda. You know, there are people out there saying, you know, we'll set fire to the world, and Jesus is going to come down and take us up to heaven. But we have been hearing about this so-called North American Union that they're trying to form to challenge the European Union. And as I've mentioned many, many times before, and you up in Canada, please pay attention to this. Before they could merge Mexico, the United States, and Canada into a single union, all of our standards of living have to be brought down to the lowest common denominator. In other words, Mexico. We, the people of the United States, have to be forced to lower our standard of living to be roughly equivalent to that of Mexico, in order for the borders to be lowered without catastrophic consequences resulting. And they're going to have to do it to Canada, too, before they can bring that border down. So maybe this is the reason we're seeing all of this terrible economic trouble, and we're not seeing our government do anything that would really effectively reverse it, bring back the high-paying jobs. The goal is to force us all to accept lower-paying jobs so that we're on par with Mexico. And I know that's a very, very disturbing thought to think about, but frankly, at this point, and call in at 800-259-9231 if you have an alternative theory, I am at a loss to explain why supposedly all these very brilliant people in Washington, D.C., and in our corporate boardrooms across America can't get a grip on the fact that the economy can't be saved until those jobs come back that we had a year ago. And, you know, I can't be the only person who understands this concept at this point. So if you've got an alternative theory why they're doing this, you know, please, please call and let me know. Meanwhile, we are starting to see this huge media campaign to smear the tax revolt movement. They're trying to say it's extreme right wing. It's just those darn rich Republicans. They don't want to pay their fair share. It's the same stuff we've been hearing all along. And there was even, believe it or not, an article coming out of one of the Israeli organizations. I'm forgetting which one it was, but it was literally saying the Tea Parties to protest taxes, they're havens for white supremacists. And they're going to be there recruiting, and you don't want to go to those tea parties because you might actually have to touch a white supremacist, and then you'll have to sterilize yourself. I mean, just really, you know, outright fear-mongering of the worst, worst sort. But here's the situation. Those who have grown rich on your tax dollars, which is pretty much everybody in Wall Street and Washington, D.C., and all the government contractors and all the local government workers, they love taxes because however much they're paying, they're getting more back. You know, government workers, by and large, get paid one-third more for the same work than people in the private sector. That sort of basically nulls out the taxes they're paying. So, you know, they get very good livings on your tax dollars. So here's the deal. Their goal is to split the tax protest movement into a left versus right, Republican versus Democrat, liberal versus conservative paradigm so that we're going to squabble amongst ourselves. Do not fall for it. It is not a question of whether the rich pay more taxes or the poor pay more taxes. It is not a question of whether Republicans should pay more taxes or Democrats. We are all taxed too much. Our economy is grinding to a halt from the burden of taxation at a time when the government tax laws send our jobs to other countries. And that is absolutely the reality. So do not fall for all of this fear-mongering. What happened in California with Arnold Schwarzenegger has sent shockwaves all through all the rest of the other 49 states and Washington, D.C., that the American people are going to stand up and say, no, we're not going to pay anymore. We don't have it. We flat out don't have it to send to you. And that 44% drop in federal tax revenues in the last year alone should have gotten that message across. The American people are out of money. Because you took the high-paying jobs away. It is that simple. And so the American people are standing up, and they're putting the blame for this economic crisis right where it belongs, right on Washington, D.C. That's where it belongs. 1999, Congress repealed the Glass-Steagall Act, and the party on Wall Street began. And here we are, $12.8 trillion into the hole, and they're just keeping it. They're just keeping it, paying themselves bonuses, having a high old time, lobbying Congress to say, look, you don't really mean for us to have to give back all those bonuses, do you? Nudge, 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 nudge. Meanwhile, we're hearing, you know, the government is trying to look like it's doing something, whether it really is or not. This is the government's response to all of these problems, okay? Even when they can't fix them. We must look like we're doing something. And so, along with all the other czars that we have of everything going on, we're now looking at the creation of a single agency to regulate the banking industry, supposedly because the patchwork of overlapping agencies that we have failed to prevent this huge financial crisis. That's not what happened. I'll tell you what happened when we get back after these words from our sponsors.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We've got a caller on the line we're going to go to in just a minute, but I just wanted to finish up this situation about the creation of yet a new agency to regulate the banking industry. Every time things go completely to heck, the government has to act like it's trying to do something, and it will create a new agency or it'll reorganize the old agencies. It's basically all eye candy, because the reality is that we had laws and we had regulatory agency that had teeth that were supposed to be keeping an eye on the banking system. And starting in 1999, 10 years ago, Congress started gutting those laws and rules. They repealed Glass-Steagall, and it's the same thing. We get a financial crisis, and the people will say, do something about it. They'll pass a bunch of laws and set up a bunch of agencies, and then as things get comfortable again, you start getting the financial people will start lobbying Congress. They'll start making huge cash donations to campaign and say, you know, the markets really can regulate themselves now. the markets can really take care of themselves. We don't need all this government oversight. And they will get Congress people like Senator John McCain, who was championing the idea of deregulation. You know, the markets are different today. They're more advanced. They're more mature. They don't need all this oversight. Well, obviously, Mr. McCain and everybody else who championed deregulation, that is not true. And so the reality is it doesn't matter if the government sets up a new single agency to regulate banking industry. It doesn't matter what laws they pass, because down the road, Congress will be bribed, it's another word for lobbying, and campaign donations, to repeal it all again. And there'll be another wild party, and everybody will say, happy days are here again, we're getting rich, then it will crash, and the losses will get dumped on you again. That's the way the system is working. The only real permanent fix is to close the Federal Reserve and to return control of the money supply of the American people to the United States Treasury, which is exactly how it was set up back in 1776. That is the only permanent fix that cannot be repealed. All right, we're going to go to the phones. We've got Drew in California. Aloha, Drew. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Well, not so much. First of all, I just want to say you're absolutely right on that as far as, you know, this, the issue of regulation, deregulation. It really doesn't matter what's on the books if the people who are supposed to be watching aren't really interested in what the rules are.
Look how long the SEC sat doing nothing while Bernie Madoff was ripping off Americans. $65 billion worth, years and years. You've got Harry Markopoulos coming in and saying, look, the guy's a crook. And the SEC just sat there and said, okay, well, we'll get around to it eventually.
Yeah,
somebody
exactly.
was yanking their leash, yeah.
What the rules are doesn't matter if the people who are supposed to be enforcing them aren't paying attention to them. So it's kind of a moot point, or, you know, listening to the news talking about, well, we need to re-regulate. If it's only going to be applied to the little guy or the unconnected, then it's not going to solve anything. You did bring up, you had asked for any, you know, possible explanation as to why our government and business leaders who seem to be so bright don't see what they're doing is doomed to failure. Really, I think it's simpler than it sounds. It's blind greed and a lifetime of indoctrination, and what they're doing is the right thing to do, and it's going to work. Makes me think of, I believe it was the Eskimos, how they used to hunt wolves. They would take a blade, they would dip it in seal blood, and they would let it freeze over, and they would do that several times until they got basically a blood popsicle. And by the time the wolf got through the blood and got down to the blade, he would have been such a bloodlust, a complete frenzy, that he wouldn't realize he was cutting his own tongue and would bleed to death, not realizing it.
Yes.
And I think it's just that simple. That's basically what's going on. This is what they understand. This is what they think will work. And they can't accept that they may have been wrong their entire lives.
Well, no, I agree with that last part. These are people of monstrous egos, and they will never admit that they're wrong or that their basic theory of operation is wrong. The other situation may simply be that they understand they really can't fix it, so they're just trying to consolidate their positions and survive in the hope that somebody else will come up with a solution somewhere down the road.
Yeah, sounds like that damn the torpedoes moment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay?
Okay, I did have one other point I wanted to make.
Please do, please do.
There was a comment the other day brought up about, you know, the continued gun buying that's basically not letting up. And
yes.
You had referred to assault weapons, assault rifles.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one term that drives me nuts to hear it because it's a loaded term. It's kind of like referring to those Iraqis that we caught in Iraq who are trying to drive us, the occupying power, out, referring to them as, you know, insurgents and terrorist suspects. An assault weapon is anything used in an assault. It's a behavior, not hardware.
That's not exactly true. And the reason has to do with the fact, if you take a hunting rifle, for example, that's not considered an assault rifle, because a hunting rifle, if you fire it at your enemy, you're probably going to kill him outright. And that's not the purpose of an assault rifle. The purpose of an assault rifle is to critically wound your enemy so that two other unwounded guys have got to help him. So assault rifles are specifically designed, first of all, to have large capacity magazines and a high rate of fire. And their intentional design is not to kill the enemy, but to wound them so it ties up more of the non-wounded people taking care of them. And that is the difference between what is considered an assault weapon and something that's used to actually intentionally kill somebody, like a sniper rifle.
And that's not entirely wrong, but then again, that was a term that was cooked up when they started trying to ban them. And the technical terms for those that particular kind of weapon is either a light carbine, light automatic rifle.
Mm-hmm.
No different from, you know, I mean, that's what they call the, you know, the M16 in the hands of a soldier, whereas put it in the hands of, you know, some gangbanger and it's an assault rifle. And so it's kind of it has some merit, but it's a loaded term meant to scare people
mm-hmm.
into negative connotations and visions of gang violence and criminals on the street.
I would agree with that last part of it. I mean, the term is designed to imply that the guns have no legitimate purpose other than to cause, mayhem. But the reality is, you know, they make great target rifles. And for those mm-hmm. of you who have farms, they make great varminting guns.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's just like that, you know, that image that we talked about, you know, not too far back with the, you know, the Korean convenience store owner with his AK-47.
That's exactly right, yes.
In that particular instance, this was a defensive weapon, not an assault weapon. He wasn't going out and chasing anybody around.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it comes back to the actual usage and, you know, instead of just the blank check, oh, this is bad.
Yeah, I hear you about that. Yeah, it is a term that is used for its spin and connotation. I will grant you that. But the idea of an assault rifle, as I understand it, as a general category, is that it is a weapon that is designed, intentionally not to kill but to seriously wound. And that's just .
Yeah, I've never heard it explained that way before. But
okay,
just my thoughts on the subject.
All right, well, no, there's merit to your position, and we probably ought to call them by something else. I mean, certainly now with the gun buying that's going on, we were talking about the gun buying on the radio, on the news break here. They were trying to basically put it in context of the fact that the police services are being cut back during the hard economy. So I guess we could call them home defense weapons now. And it's the same gun, and it's the same, but now it's got a positive spin. It is a home defense weapon.
Yeah.
Okay?
I'm not far off from that. I think that'll do it.
All right. Well, then, Drew, thanks an awful lot for the phone call and call in again. And, when you get into this issue of gun control and the gun grabbers, you know, they're going to try and always portray guns and gun owners in the worst possible light because the statistics are against them. We reported yesterday it's been almost a year since the Supreme Court overturned Washington, D.C.'s gun ban, and the residents of Washington, D.C. have gone out and bought guns. And violent crime has gone down. No big surprise to those of us paying attention. And if you want to know what kind of people gun owners and gun enthusiasts really are, go visit a gun store, because you're never going to find a more polite and respectful bunch of people than hang out at the gun stores and the gun ranges, because they understand respect is how accidents are prevented. We're going to take a break. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. Got a couple of stories to finish up the hour today here, and we'll be back tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. Central Time for our two-hour Saturday wrap-up here. Today, Barack Obama got up, and as I said before, when the government wants to look like they're trying to solve the problems, they'll create a new officer agency. And so Barack Obama got up and started talking about a new czar of cybersecurity. And he started out talking about all the problems with identity theft and hacking and phishing and all the rest of it. Of course, we all recognize that this could very well be a political cover to bring about censorship of content on blogs that the U.S. government or other governments don't like. We just found out that whatreallyhappened.com, as of the last time anybody was able to test it, we're actually blocked in China now, which is amazing because I don't do a lot of stories about China, but that's of the last word is that we're not reachable in China on that whole thing. But getting back to the situation, during the speech, Barack Obama shared this story how his one of his main campaign websites, not the financial one, but one of his main campaign websites was subject to repeated hacker attack between August and October of 2008 during the height of the campaign. And Obama is very open about the fact that they used the internet and blogs and Twitter and everything very, very, very effectively during his campaign. One of the first, in fact, I think it is the first political campaign to have really made such a major usage of the internet, and they were being hacked. And the instant he said that they were having all of these problems, and great that the hackers annoyed the President of the United States and attacked his website, because maybe we'll finally see something getting done by these bozos. But it brought back to mind the gentleman by the name of Michael Connell, who was a Republican computer IT expert. He set up a whole bunch of the GOP websites and web servers, and he was involved in the 2004 election fraud case. In fact, in December of last year, about 2 months, well, basically a month after the election was over, he was flying up to testify in federal court on the vote fraud 2004 issue when his single-engine plane just fell out of the sky. Isn't that amazing? And it just, all of a sudden, I don't know why I'm thinking that there might well be a link here, but it just struck me as rather odd that, you know, that Barack Obama was being hacked by somebody who obviously was opposed to his running for president. That means it's Republican of some kind. And we had that story there. Anyway, getting away from that, I want to get back into the torture scandal. This is not going to go away, folks. I am not going to let it go away. This is the worst scandal in our nation's history. It is the blackest of black marks. And the world is never going to believe that we are repentant or sorry until we have war crimes trials followed by imprisonment of the guilty party. And we have all of these politicians saying, well, we were wrong, but we must look forward and not focus so much on the past here. Now, today, on Fox News, General David Petraeus, the head of the U.S. Central Command, stated flat out the U.S. had violated the Geneva Conventions in its war in Iraq. Just flat out said, violated the Geneva Convention. And then he goes on to say, you know, but yes, we need to look forward and not look back. And, you know, we're just going to renew our commitment to justice in the international arena and blah, 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 blah. So he's basically saying, we're sorry we did it. We won't do it again. Honest. Well, you know, the whole reason for having trials and punishment is to create a deterrent. If you don't punish a thief, and you just take their word, I'll never do it again, the recidivism rate there is pretty high. They're probably going to come back and do it again. And what I keep thinking when I was listening to Petraeus talk about this stuff, and when I listened to Obama saying the same thing about how we can't focus on the past, we must look forward and everything, can you imagine anybody standing up at the Nuremberg trials at the close of World War II and saying that? The Nazis standing up and saying, well, we really should look forward in how we're going to, you know, handle ourselves in the future, and we ought not to focus on the past. I mean, that's not going to fly in Nuremberg. I mean, try telling Israel that it's time to stop obsessing about the past, meaning the Holocaust, and we've got to look to the future. Like, how are you going to stop dropping white phosphorus on the children in Gaza? It's not going to fly there either. This is a very self-serving attitude of saying, we don't want to look at the past, let's just look forward. Yeah, we want to look at the past, because we're still paying for it. You and I and your children's children are going to be paying the price, financially and morally, for what has happened over the last 8 years. We will be paying that for the rest of our lives. So it's not like it's gone and everybody's dead and the guilty are dead and the victims are dead and it's all part of history. We're not talking about the first half of the last century here. We're talking about a few weeks ago, a few months ago, may even still be ongoing is the real reason we should be looking at this. And so I am very angry. I am glad that Petraeus got up there and forthrightly said they're violating the Geneva Conventions, which is not a newsflash to anybody. And then he turns around and says, well, we're sorry, we won't do it again, and just proceeds to say, you know, that's the end of the subject. And no, it is not. And I'm not going to let it be the end of the subject. And neither should you. Because if we let this government get away with torturing people, innocent people, to death, children, if we let them get away with that, What's going to happen when they decide that you're a terror suspect, or I'm a terror suspect, or my wife, the liturgical church music composer? What if they think she's a terrorist? What do you think? I mean, we had that videotape from the police the other day. Responded to a call from a woman who was the victim. She called 911. They arrested her and strip searched her in front of men and women, forcibly, ripped her clothes off. Still don't know why. That one's probably going to go into the courts. But I'm saying this idea of abuse and torture is already spreading through the interior of the United States. It's now acceptable behavior. Because we wrote a blank check and a get-out-of-jail-free card for the Bush administration torturers in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo. So guess what? The police of the United States of America are going to think, well, hey, you know, we can go, you know, whoop on people. We had that sheriff got sent to jail for waterboarding a confession out of a prisoner. And the Supreme Court has just now told police, you can interrogate your suspects without a lawyer present. So who knows what's going to start happening now? If we don't draw the line someplace on this, the clearest possible violation of international U.S. law is the torturing of these people. And we are, again, from numerous sources around the world and in Europe, getting confirmation that these photos that Obama is refusing to release do, in fact, show much greater atrocities than we've already been made aware of, including sexual abuse and abuse of children, which cannot be justified. And as a caller to this show pointed out a couple of days ago, the people hanging on to these photos, that's child porn. You can go to jail just for having them and keeping them private and secret. Okay, so anyway, all right, we've got a caller on the line. We're going to go to Chris in Texas. Aloha, Chris. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Hey, I like your show. I listen to it every day on the way to work.
Good.
And
thank
I was thinking about the assault weapon discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought of assault weapons as a rapid-fire weapon. And I would think that because you can get semi-automatic, the only weapon you can really buy legally without going through miles of red tape is a semi-automatic weapon.
Correct.
So I would think that an assault rifle should probably be defined as an automatic weapon. Because I think that's how they're characterizing them.
I know that that's a feature of assault weapons, and to sort of agree with my previous caller on the subject, unfortunately, the media tends to call even the semi-automatic versions of them as assault rifles because they kind of look the same. And for those of you familiar with guns and a little gizmo called the Hellfire, getting rapid fire out of them is actually rather easy to do. So it's a fine point. But like I said, let's not use the term assault rifle anymore. They're home defense weapons, and it doesn't matter if they're semi-automatic or fully automatic. You know, they are home defense weapons because we need to defend our homes against the criminals both inside and outside of government.
I agree. And also a good point is that the, especially here in Texas, home defense weapons have greater leeway. A shotgun can only have a 3-shell choke on it if it's used for hunting, but for home defense, it can have an 8-round choke on it.
Yeah, all right. We got to let you go. The music means it's the end of the show, Chris, and you're absolutely right about that situation here. One more. No, I'm going to save this for 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. We've got another story about the London 7-7 bombing case, but we're out of time. So until tomorrow morning at 11, stay safe, be well, hug your loved ones, drive carefully. Lots of cinnamon. The swine flu is still floating around out there. And please share this show with everybody you know on your Twitter, your Facebook, your MySpace, whatever. Please tell them about what we're trying to do here. We're trying to prevent World War III. Until tomorrow, aloha, America.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.